So in previous weeks, we've seen something of Shruti texts, these texts that are considered to be eternal or divinely revealed, unauthored, that have no human origin in tradition. And we've seen that these basically correspond to what is popularly called the Vedas. But the Vedas are a very complex group of texts. Because what is generally sort of Veda in the narrow sense are the four samhitas, the four collections, but then they have additional supplementary texts, the Brahmanas, the Aranyakas, and then finally the Upanishads. The first three of these, as we've seen, deal with Vedic ritual, and in the sense that at least three of these Samhita texts are used in ritual. The fourth, the Atharvaveda, is a slightly different text. But then the Brahmanas and Aranyakas particularly develop the theology around the centrality of Vedic ritual, about the centrality of yagya, of sacrifice. And as we've seen, so this is all about karma, about action, specifically ritual action, but also, as we've seen later, the notion of dharma sort of falls under the notion of karma as well. The Upanishads, on the other hand, as we've seen, although they seem to be part of the same revelation, and the Upanishads themselves make that claim repeatedly, these texts, though they incorporate a lot of Vedic material and a lot of discussions on ritual, they move away from ritual and they stress the importance of jnana, of knowledge, particularly knowledge of Brahman, which is the ground of all being, the foundation of all existence, the ultimate reality. And in some Upanishads, as we've seen, is actually seen in very theistic terms as a personal God who creates the world, maintains the world, and into whom the world is dissolved. Whereas some other Upanishads are more have a more non-theistic understanding of Brahman. We've then seen that supplementary to these texts is another category of text, which are these smritis, literally memory, which are texts that tradition sees to be authored by a particular individual, so they have a beginning in time, they have an author, and we've seen a number of texts that are associated, that sort of fall within this category. So the most prominent ones would be the different sutra texts, which are ritual manuals that actually tell you how to perform the rituals that are prescribed and described in these texts. But then, so we have, for example, the Shrauta Sutras, there's a few other ones, but we can ignore them for now. And then we also saw there are the Dharma Sutras, which are texts that deal with dharma, that deal with right conduct, ethical codes, duties of the different classes of society. And the Dharma Sutras are very much part of this Vedic tradition. The sort of ideal life that they prescribe is the life of someone who follows the ritual tradition of the Vedic texts. But then there's another sort of, more broadly speaking, there's another sort of group of texts that are not so closely linked to the Vedic tradition, but that are deal with the same subject, and these are broadly called the Dharma Shastra, literally the texts on Dharma, the treatises on Dharma, the most famous of which is Manu, the Manusmriti, or the Manava Dharma Shastra, or variously called, but that's kind of one of these texts that sort of falls within this. Now, these texts are all considered to be smriti, so they're all considered to be written by specific individuals, but it also means that they're dependent on their authority, on the authority of the Vedas. And they're very clear about this, these texts. They claim that they're teaching nothing new, and that everything they're teaching is sort of contained within the Vedic ritual tradition. And they're merely elaborating on these texts. As I said, the traditional understanding is that this means memory, this means hearing. And so the traditional phrase is that you cannot remember something that you have not heard before. And so whatever these texts teach is seen to be in some way in the Vedic texts themselves. And this is particularly sort of clear with these ritual manuals like the Shraddha Sutras, which merely kind of say, here's all these references in these Vedic texts about various rituals, but here's actually how you perform these rituals. We were sort of systematized it and made it into a manual, so it's easy to follow what you need to do at what time. Now, the category of smriti is a very fluid one, actually, and it's a category that sort of a lot of texts are added to it over the centuries, and not everyone always agrees exactly what sort of the boundary of smriti. But the texts we'll be looking at today are often considered part of smriti, in that they have make a similar claim that what they're teaching is derived from the Vedic texts and depends for its authority on the Vedic texts. And it's also considered to be written by specific individuals at specific times. And yet, at the same time, as we'll see, the texts are kind of often seen as sort of a separate category as well. And those texts are, as you have on the handout, which you should all have, if not, there's a few more at the back, and the Mahabharata and the Ramayana.
What are the dates? What dates? When?
Of all of them? This is kind of an open-ended category, so it's sort of, the Dharma Sutras are generally seen to be fairly early, so that's kind of 4th century BC or so, give or take a few centuries. So it's very difficult to date things in an Indian context for these texts, primarily because we have, for a lot of these texts, like particularly when it comes to these, we have a lot of texts and we have very little sort of other historical sort of data that allows us to back this up fairly easily. As one scholar once said, it's dating a text is like putting up a bowling pin. You sort of put it up in order to knock it down again later on, because it's kind of, you constantly have to revise sort of the dating. But like the Manu, for example, is generally dated probably 4th century AD. So that's, so it's kind of a very wide range periods. But the text we'll talk about today, the dating of those is also very contested, as we'll see, partly because of the question whether they're written by a single individual or whether they're texts that sort of grew organically over the centuries, where various people added things over the centuries. And scholars have sort of, there's two camps basically. Some argue, there's clearly sort of a unity to these texts that signals that these must have been written by a single author, even if some specific parts may have been added later. But other scholars argue, there was just a very small core of these texts and these gradually grew and grew and grew. Because these texts, particularly the Mahabharata, is massive. The Mahabharata is said to have 100,000 verses, so it's a really enormous text. And so that's kind of why. And it's kind of a text that on the surface seems to be rambling a lot, in that, you kind of get sort of there's a story that is told, and then you get a story within a story, and a story within a story, and a story within that story. And it's sort of, it's kind of sometimes hard to sort of follow the plot. Some scholars have argued actually that there is kind of, despite that, there is a clear sort of progression of ideas and sort of a real coherence to it. Whereas some have argued, these are kind of, demonstrate different layers of the text over the centuries. And as a result of that, some texts like the Mahabharata has been dated from anywhere to second century BC to second century AD. So it's sort of somewhere in that sort of period. Now, the Mahabharata and Ramayana are often sort of listed in here, but they're often given a separate name as well, which is Itihasa, which is often translated as histories, and it literally comes from Itihasa. Thus, indeed, it was, and so it's kind of these are said to be histories. And often they're kind of grouped together like that. In practice, though, when authors, later Hindu authors, refer to Itihasa in their writings, generally they only mean the Mahabharata. That's kind of the more prominent text for later traditions, as we'll see. And so it's kind of these two have sort of a somewhat separate status from the other Smriti texts, even though they're often seen to be Smriti texts. And the reason for that, is because they're narrative texts, and they're very different from any of the other texts that we've seen. So if you look at the Dharmashastras, they're just sort of codes of, you know, this is how an ideal a follower of Vedic tradition should live. The Shauta Sutras are ritual manuals that tell you, you know, this is how you do this at such and such time. Whereas these texts are different. They're narratives, they're stories that are told. And They kind of, in telling these stories, they deal particularly with the notion of dharma, and so they're often sort of seen to be dharma shastras in some ways as well, but they're dharma shastras in a very different sense. And they're dharma shastras in the sense that they talk about dharma and they comment on dharma, but they're not actually making it sort of, they're not sort of providing a clear template of what it is that you need to follow. And this is particularly true of the Mahabharata. Now, the stories they tell are India's most famous stories. The Ramayana tells the story of Ram, who is a king, a prince, a crown prince in Ayodhya in the north, will be coronated king, but then due to some happenings, some politics at the court, gets banished before his coronation. He moves with his wife and his brother, Sita and Lakshmana. They move to the forest. Sita then gets kidnapped by Ravana, who's an asura, a demonic king from the south. Rama and Lakshmana go in search of Sita, and in the course of that, get involved with the politics of the monkey kingdom, and then get the allies of the monkey army, particularly the great warrior Hanuman, and then conquer Ravana's kingdom in Lanka, and finally rescue Sita, return to Ayodhya, and become king. Ram and Sita become king and queen, only to then for Ram then to banish Sita when the citizens of his kingdom have doubts about whether Sita would have been faithful while she was kidnapped by Ravana, and so Ram banishes her from the kingdom, and that's kind of the end. It's a very tragic story, but it's a story that sort of permeates everything in Hindu culture and in Indian culture. There's Buddhist retellings, there's Jain retellings of it. It's spread to Southeast Asia and so on. And it's one of those stories that A.K. Ramanujan, who is a very prominent scholar of the text just a couple of decades ago, who passed away, he argued that, or he famously said that in India, no one hears the story of the Ramayana for the first time. It's kind of so embedded in the culture that you just grow up with it, and it's you never hear it for the first time. In the Ramayana, Rama is okay. Well, we'll come back to that in a moment. The Mahabharata tells a similar epic story, again dealing with kshatriyas, dealing with kings, and tells the story of the descendants of Bharata, the Bharatas. And so the Mahabharata is the great Bharata, sort of the great epic about the Bharatas. It tells how it sort of has a very long backstory to it, but the core of the story is basically the fight between two branches of the same family, where the eldest son at some point, who's supposed to be king, is born blind and is therefore unfit to rule. So his brother, his younger brother, becomes king. But then when his younger brother dies, then his son, there becomes a dispute over the kingdom between the sons of the person who was ruling as king, Pandu, and the sons of the blind king, who was not fit to rule because of his blindness, Dhritarashtra. And that leads to a full-on war. And that's kind of the sort of, in a very brief nutshell, the story. You might be very familiar with that already. I don't know. But there's a lot of, there's a lot of sort of televised versions of them and turn into movies and so on. So if you want a quick overview, there's a few. There's also not so quick overviews. There's the famous Mahabharata TV series that will keep you occupied for days and days and days if you want to watch it all. That's kind of the core of the stories. Now, one thing that's kind of obvious is immediately is that they're both stories about kshatriyas. They're both stories about kings and warriors. And and this is kind of, in a sense, a break from the Dharma Shastras themselves, which, even though they deal with kshatriyas, as we've seen, the sort of the default position is always addressing the Brahmins. Most of these texts, particularly the Dharma Sutras, seem to be entirely written for Brahmins, and then kind of as an afterthought is like, oh, by the way, if you're a kshatriya, this is what you should do. The Dharma Shastras, some of the later Dharma Shastras do incorporate more of the kshatriyas, but again, the sort of default position is the assumption is that you're a Brahmin. Whereas the Ramayana and Mahabharata talk about kshatriya dharma, about the dharma of kshatriyas, and they both have a lot to say about it through these stories. And they kind of address the concerns of kshatriya dharma in very different ways. In the Ramayana, Rama is presented as the ideal king, and he follows dharma to its utter, to its sort of in the most complete way that is possible. He's sort of presented as the dharmic king, as the ideal king that every king should aspire to follow, to the extent that, you know, he sacrifices every sort of concern for his own well-being for the benefit of his kingdom. And that's kind of why at the end, when he's reunited with Sita after, you know, this long battle and the searching for her, and he's back in Ayodhya, and he hears that some citizens of his kingdom are questioning whether Sita is still pure, and whether, you know, she gave in to the advances of Ravana in order to sort of, Ram puts his sort of kingdom first over his personal concerns, and therefore, even though the text kind of at length describes his great anguish and suffering in the act of banishing her, he banishes her because the kingdom is more important. And it's kind of this ideal of the Dharmic king that's painful almost to watch. It's sort of Ram is a man who's so principled that it's kind of, it becomes uncomfortable. And it's kind of the Hindu tradition sort of has that attitude towards it. The Ramayana has been retold, you know, countless times. Generally, they sort of leave out the end where he banishes Sita, because that's sort of too painful for them to sort of consider. And so the end is kind of they're happily ever after living in Ayodhya and ruling the kingdom. So that's kind of the depiction of dharma of the kshatriya in the Ramayana. In the Mahabharata, it's a lot more complicated. And one of the recurring themes in the Mahabharata is that dharma is really difficult to understand. And it's kind of a critique of the Dharma Shastras in a way, where the Dharma Shastras give sort of very clear guidelines of what it is you should do and what dharma is. Whereas the Mahabharata, through its narratives, through its sort of embedded stories, it always complicates this. And the sort of the running theme in the Mahabharata is that it is very difficult to understand what is the right thing to do in a particular situation, and that dharma is not a fixed thing. It is not something that is just prescribed in text, but is something that has to be judged on a case-by-case basis. And that what is sort of dharmic in one situation will not be dharmic in another situation. And this is kind of done through various didactic stories in the text. You know, there's a very famous story of a Brahmana called Kaushika, who is sort of known as this very dharmic Brahmin who's never speaks a lie and who's sort of the embodiment of truth, as Brahmins are supposed to be according to the Dharma Shastra. And there's these robbers, these people that are sort of fleeing from some danger that pass by his house, and they ask him, you know, where can we hide, where can we find shelter? And he says, oh, go over there in those caves and, you know, you'll be safe there. So they rush in there, and, you know, a couple of minutes after they've passed by, there's a group of robbers that come by, and they say, oh, have you seen those people, you know, that passed by here? And he said, oh yes, they're over in that cave. And so these robbers go and they kill everyone, and when Kaushika dies, he ends up in hell. And he's sort of, you know, shocked by this, and he says, but I follow Dharma, I was truthful, you know. And sort of the critique is that, no, you know, this was not a situation in which truthfulness was Dharma, actually. In that case, it would actually have been dharmic for Kaushika to tell a lie. And so you get these stories like that told again and again that sort of say, you know, this is difficult, this is complicated to understand. But it primarily does this through the narrative as a whole. And so you get this story of these sort of warring factions of the same extended family. And they're all kshatriyas, they're all warriors, they're all sort of the embodiment of the kshatriya virtues that you find in dharmashastric texts. You know, they're powerful, they're proud, they're following dharma and so on. And yet, you know, in sort of telling the story, you get this very subtle way in which the Mahabharata kind of says, you know, well, what is Kshatriya Dharma actually about? What it is to be a proper king? And the reason that I say this is because the person who's most presented as the ideal Kshatriya, or as at least the ideal king, is Yudhishthira. And Yudhishthira is... So, okay, let me just... how many of you are familiar with the Mahabharata story? Somewhat. Okay, so you have two brothers. I have to get into this a little bit, otherwise this will be very confusing. So you have Dhritarashtra. He's the blind king, and so he's the eldest, but he's blind, and so he's not he's born blind. He's therefore not fit to become the king, and so he. The kingdom goes to his brother, his younger brother, called Pandu, and he becomes the king, and he has five sons, and his eldest is Yudhishthira, and then you have Arjuna, you have Bhima. And then you have twins, Nakula and Sahadeva. And Dhritarashtra has 100 sons, which I won't list, but his sort of chief son is Duryodhana. Dhritarashtra is supposed to be king, but he's blind, so because he's the eldest, so the kingdom goes to Pandu. But Pandu dies very, very shortly after he's married and so on. And so he's dead. And so what happens is Yudhishthira, if you follow the succession of kings, Yudhishthira is the one who should be king in some ways, because he's the eldest son of Pandu. But Duryodhana, he claims that he should be king because he's the eldest son of the actual, sort of in a sense, the person who should have been king, Dhritarashtra, his own father. And so you kind of get this sort of battle between these five brothers and Duryodhana and his brothers and their allies. And And Yudhishthira, the Mahabharata, is basically the whole story of the Mahabharata is about how Yudhishthira in the end becomes king. This is a big spoiler if you want to read through the Mahabharata, but in the end Yudhishthira becomes king, and he becomes king, and the whole battle that takes place, which is the biggest chunk of the Mahabharata, is actually a description of the battle, is kind of the battle is fought in order to put Yudhishthira on the throne, because he's presented as the ideal king. He embodies dharma to its greatest extent. He's the dharma raja, the king of dharma, the dharma king. And he's that also in a very special way, because the five sons of Pandu, the five Pandavas, these are the Pandavas, the descendants of Pandu. These actually are seen the text sort of tells that these are actually sons of different gods, of different devas. It's a complicated story that we don't have to get into now. But Yudhishthira is actually the son of the god Dharma, which is Yama, the god of death. So the Mahabharata portrays him as sort of the embodiment of Dharma, the son of Dharma himself, the ideal king. And yet Yudhishthira is a very complicated person in the text, because he doesn't actually embody what Dharma Shastra sort of prescribes to be the Kshatriya Dharma. And actually Yudhishthira more embodies what the Dharma Shastra prescribes for Brahmins. He emphasizes truthfulness and non-violence and simplicity and so on, all values that are associated with Brahmins, and that Kshatriyas are not supposed to follow. Kshatriyas don't follow Ahimsa because they're warriors, so they fight. Kshatriyas are allowed to tell lies and so on in certain situations. And so Yudhishthira is this sort of complicated figure where he's presented as the ideal Kshatriya, and yet he doesn't embody what is sort of traditionally seen to be Kshatriya values. And indeed, he speaks throughout the Mahabharata, he speaks very negatively about Kshatriya Dharma. And I think you have a passage in the handouts on that. At the bottom of page 2, you have there Yudhishthira and Kshatriya Dharma. Where he says, you know, we will try first to make peace with our enemies, but if that fails, then we must take up arms in a righteous cause. However, the slaughter of kinsmen and elders will indeed be a sinful act, as Sanjaya, another character in the text, has said. So what is to be gained from battle? Alas, this Kshatriya Dharma is indeed sinful, and we have taken birth among the Kshatriyas. Anyway, he kind of goes on and on about this. He says, the Kshatriya Dharma is a dharma of dogs, you know, just fighting for a bone, and there's sort of nothing sort of elevated about this. And, you know, why are we sort of involved in this fight? And so you kind of get him sort of presented as the ideal Kshatriya. But there's other characters in the text too that are sort of presented as the ideal Kshatriyas. This comes out very clearly in the text with sort of the relationship between Yudhishthira and his brothers. Now, the complicated thing about their family is that they all have one wife. They all are married to a woman called Draupadi. So she has five husbands. And the story of that is, you know, she's sort of won in a contest. By one of them, when sort of the mother hears about it, she says, well, whatever you won, you have to share with your brothers. And then she finds out it was a wife he had won, so you know, she ends up marrying all five. And Draupadi is this immensely powerful woman in the text, in the sense that she has a very strong voice, and she constantly critiques Yudhishthira. In the fight between the Pandavas, between the five brothers and Duryodhana, at some point the Pandavas get exiled from the kingdom and they live in the wilderness. And just after that happens, there's a very famous passage in the Mahabharata where Draupadi kind of turns to Yudhishthira and says, you know, what kind of a Kshatriya are you that you can tolerate something like this? You know, such great injustice is done to you, and you just go like yeah, okay, fine, we'll live in the forest. You know, he's like, you should step up and fight, and you should claim your throne, and, you know, you're a wimp. And it's kind of, you get this sort of constant critique of Draupadi towards Yudhishthira. And sort of, so through the voice of Draupadi, you kind of get this sort of critique of the ideal king of Yudhishthira as being not the ideal king, that he's not sort of the proper king. And through her, you get Bhima presented as the ideal king, as the ideal kshatriya. And Bhima is the son of Vayu, the son of the god of wind, the son of Vayu, of the god of wind. And he is an immensely powerful warrior, like physically very strong. And his reaction to injustice is just, you know, smash the guy to a pulp. And it's kind of sort of this immediate justice that takes place. In their exile, Draupadi is repeatedly she's immensely beautiful, and all men kind of fall for her, and there's all these people that want to kidnap her and make her their wife and so on. And Yudhishthira's response to those incidents is always like, well, we should forgive and we should be tolerant and we should not sort of engage in sort of violent retribution. Bhima's response is, let's smash them, you know, let's just beat them to a pulp, let's kill them. And it's kind of, he's in a sense, sort of, you get sort of this sort of alternative mode of a kshatriya, where, you know, he's violent, but he's violent within sort of the constraints of dharma. He will not sort of be violent sort of in sort of a random way, but he'll be violent for the sake of maintaining dharma. And you kind of get this other sort of ideal, that here's an ideal of dharma of a kshatriya in sort of that's totally at odds with Yudhishthira. But then the further complication you get in the Mahabharata is that Duryodhana, who's constantly portrayed as sort of a wicked king, a selfish king, who does not have a lot of great virtues, and so on, who ends up ruling the kingdom by cheating Yudhishthira and his brothers and out of the kingdom and getting them banished. And yet, at the end of the Mahabharata, Duryodhana is presented as an ideal kshatriya as well, because he ruled the kingdom and he maintained kshatriya dharma. And you get actually a very sort of strong monologue almost of Yudhishthira at the end of the book, where he says, you know, what's the point of so many people died in this battle to put me on the throne, but Duryodhana would have done an equally good job. You know, he was a good king. He took care of his subjects. Yes, he was selfish and so on, but he took care of his subjects. And so there's sort of this alternative ideal of a king sort of presenting there. And so it's kind of, as you read through the story, it gets very complicated. Okay, well, what is dharma actually? What is it that you should follow in you know, which ideal do you follow? And the Mahabharata doesn't really answer that. And that's kind of the strength, in a sense, of the Mahabharata and the appeal of the Mahabharata for so many centuries. In that it argues, it is complex. You know, we cannot sort of make a black and white sort of statement that this is what is dharma in all situations. And dharma can take on many different forms. It has to be judged on an individual basis. And there is no sort of fixed rule of dharma. And this is something that Yudhishthira particularly kind of repeatedly emphasizes when he speaks in the Mahabharata. There is a very explicit critique of Dharmashastra in there. Yudhishthira, in a very famous passage, says, well, how do we know what is dharma? He says, if we look to the shastras, if we look to the scriptures, if we look to the Dharmashastras, we see that they're divided on it. You know, one says in this situation, this is the right thing to do. Another says, this is the right thing to do. And he says, so we cannot follow these texts. He says, even if we go to the sages are divided on this. You know, the sages have different opinions, and so we cannot follow them. And so in the end, he says, you know, you follow someone you aspire to emulate. You follow a great person, and that is the path of dharma. And that is the way of living a dharmic life. Now, the added complication to all this sort of discussion on dharma is that both the Ramayana and the Mahabharata have another element sort of in their texts. in that both of these texts are actually stories that involve an avatar. And the notion of avatar is very prominent in these texts, and it basically literally means a descent. And it's the idea that God, in a very theistic sense, descends into this world in order to uphold Dharma, in order to sort of ensure that Dharma is upheld. In the Ramayana, Rama is seen as an avatar and they're both they're avatars of Vishnu or Narayana, which is two names for the same person. Vishnu in these texts is identified with the Brahman of the Upanishads, and there's, particularly between the Mahabharata and some of the more theistic Upanishads, there's a lot of overlap. There's whole passages that you find in both texts. And so it kind of builds on the theistic traditions of that is found in the Upanishads and claims that Brahman is Vishnu, and at certain times Vishnu descends into this world in order to uphold Dharma. And this is the case in the Ramayana, where Rama descends to show the ideal life of a king and sort of the Dharmic king to sort of its most its greatest perfection. But here, in the story of the Mahabharata, there is also an avatar involved, and that is Krishna. And Krishna is an ally of the Pandavas. He's a friend, particularly of Arjuna, but of all the Pandavas. And we'll see more about him next week when we look at a key text that is sort of a key set of chapters in the Mahabharata that's seen as a separate text called the Bhagavad Gita, which is spoken on the eve of the great battle by Krishna to Arjuna. So we'll see more about their relationship and sort of the significance of him later. But the important sort of how Krishna complicates this this notion of what is Dharma in the Mahabharata even further is that he's a very different sort of avatar than Ram is. Ram is the avatar and the sort of the Dharmic king in the sense that he shows the ideal of a Dharmic king. He shows what you have to do in order to live a life of Dharma. Krishna, on the other hand, it repeatedly violates Dharma in the text. And he's sort of presented as God who's beyond the rules of Dharma. He doesn't have to follow Dharma, even though he generally does. But throughout the text, he does things that sort of according to Dharma are not supposed to be done. You know, he tells Yudhishthira during the battle to tell a lie. Yudhishthira's teacher, his sort of warrior teacher, is one of the best warriors on the other side of the army. He fights for Duryodhana, in order to get him to stop fighting, or at least to sort of, you know, be less good in the battle, and therefore, you know, not wipe out the army of the Pandavas, Krishna sort of tells Yudhishthira that you should tell him that his son died, and if he hears that his son died, he will lose his sort of desire to fight, or at least his sort of spirit to fight. But his son is not dead, and so it's kind of Krishna telling Yudhishthira to tell a lie. Yudhishthira then kind of going like, how can I tell a lie? This goes against Dharma, and you know, this is the inappropriate thing to do. And that's kind of where Krishna sort of comes in repeatedly, kind of saying like, you know, it's okay, you can break Dharma here. This is not a bad thing. And it's kind of what the Mahabharata is sort of portraying in that. Is sort of saying that there is a higher dharma that can be followed as well, and that is kind of it's a discussion that occurs in particularly in texts after this that sort of repeatedly is brought up, is that what is actually the grounds of dharma? How do we know what dharma ultimately is? And there are some who argue, well, dharma is whatever the Dharma Shastra says, but there are also traditions that start to argue, and texts that start to argue that dharma is that which is ordained by God. And so what is dharmic is not sort of dharmic in and of itself, but it is dharmic because God has ordained it. And so that's kind of what here the Mahabharata is playing on. Why is Yudhishthira telling a lie not considered breaking dharma, and why is it sort of presented as sort of an okay thing to do, is because it's sort of saying, well, because Krishna, who is the avatar of Vishnu, who is identified with Brahman throughout the text, because he orders Yudhishthira to tell a lie, therefore there is no breaking of dharma. And it's kind of raising the discussion to a higher level and kind of saying, if we look at it from this point of view, everything changes yet again. And so it's kind of, this is the Mahabharata, just making everything complicated and sort of, you end up, you know, having read the text and, you know, if you read through the whole story, you know, 100,000 verses, you kind of end up in the end there kind of like, so if I'm a Kshatriya, what am I supposed to do? And sort of, who should I follow? And what is the correct thing to do? And it's sort of in a way, through the narrative, there is more emphasis put on Yudhishthira. As I said, you know, you read through the Mahabharata, the bulk of the Mahabharata is a description of the final battle, the final confrontation between Duryodhana's armies and his allies' armies and the armies of the Pandavas and their allies. And it's a battle that lasts 18 days, and it's the description of it is gruesome. It's just like just chapter after chapter, descriptions of severed limbs and rivers of blood, and it's kind of you read through this, and it kind of by the end of it, you really kind of understand Yudhishthira's point, because at the end he has sort of this long discussion on ahimsa, on non-violence as sort of the highest, and it's kind of having read through the whole battle, you kind of go like, yeah, you know, I'm with this guy, you know, non-violence is the good thing to do here, while at the same time kind of, you know, allowing for, you know, Yudhishthira himself, he fights on the battle, he fights in the battlefield, and so he, you know, it's kind of complicating all this. Now, what the Mahabharata is doing is kind of, you know, it's clearly building on a lot of the other ideas here. It's sort of critiquing the Dharma Sutras. It's incorporating the Upanishads in sort of its notion of Brahman, and particularly sort of a theistic understanding of Brahman through the figure of Krishna. And it repeatedly has sort of these long interludes of discussions on Vedic ritual and on asceticism and on various topics found in the Upanishads and so on. And in doing that, it kind of says, yes, what we're teaching, what the Mahabharata is teaching, is Smriti in the sense that it is dependent on the Shrutis for its authority. And we're not teaching anything new. But everything that we're teaching is there in Vedic text. Yet the Mahabharata makes a further claim than that. And we have some passages about that on the beginning of the handout. And that is, it says that this is the fifth Veda. So we have the four Vedic texts with all their supplementary material. And the Mahabharata very clearly at the beginning declares itself to be the fifth Veda. And in doing that, it's kind of referring back to passages you find in the Upanishads. I gave you two there from Brihadaranyaka and the Chandogya, which talk about the Itihasa as being the fifth Veda. As you get there in the second one, it's a passage we saw last week of Narada saying to Sanat Kumar in the Chandogya. He says, and this is kind of the bottom of that first sort of section there, of the second quote, where he says, I have studied the Rig Veda, sir, as also the Yajur Veda, the Sama Veda, the Atharvana as the fourth, the corpus of histories and ancient tales as the fifth Veda among the Vedas. And so it's kind of the Mahabharata is sort of alluding to this, and see the Itihasa, that's the word used there, the Itihasa that the Chandogya and the Brihadaranyaka and other Upanishads talk about as being the fifth Veda, this is us, this is what we are. Most scholars and indeed most traditional commentators on the text argue that the Itihasa that is referred to in the Chandogya is not the Mahabharata, it's sort of a different group of texts than we no longer have. But kind of the Mahabharata clearly kind of sees itself as sort of being the extension of that, and therefore being part of that tradition. And in doing that, the Mahabharata kind of goes one step further and argues that actually this is the fifth Veda, and this is the more important of the Vedas. And in what it says is that The Vedic texts, they're only accessible to twice-born men. as we've seen when in the context of Dharma Shastra. So only if you're a Brahmana, Kshatriya, or a Vaishya, and you have undergone the Vedic initiation, can you study these texts. And so Shudras, the laborer class, are not allowed to read these texts. Women are, at least according to Dharma Shastra, also not allowed to read these texts. The Mahabharata says, this is the fifth Veda, and this is the Veda that Shudras and women and relatives of Brahmins, meaning Brahmins who don't live up to their sort of family heritage, they can study this text. This is the text that is suitable for anyone who does not have, who has not received the Vedic initiation. And so we're teaching what the Vedic texts are teaching, but we're teaching it in a more accessible manner that anyone can approach. It kind of goes one step further, and it even argues that in sort of doing that, it's basically saying that we are not just the fifth of the Vedas and therefore, you know, equal with the other Vedas. We're actually more important because what the Mahabharata claims at the beginning and the end of the text is it's saying that whatever is found in Vedic texts is found here, but it's found here in a more accessible way. So why bother your time with sort of memorizing the Vedic texts and you know, studying these texts and kind of hoping to understand what they're about when you can do this very easily by just reading this text. And it's a story, so it's pleasant to read and so on. And both at the beginning and the end, the Mahabharata makes this bold claim where it says, whatever is found elsewhere is found here. Whatever is not found here in this text is not found anywhere else. And so it's kind of claiming that sort of this is the universal knowledge that is to be found. And therefore, this is kind of the most important of all the texts. The Ramayana is a very different text in that regard, because the Ramayana kind of portrays Ram as the ideal king, doesn't sort of claim that same status as the Mahabharata does. Although by later traditions it's often seen to be sort of on an equal level with the Mahabharata. But it's also doesn't have so many explicitly didactic passages in it. It's more sort of a pure story that is told with very little theological discussion. The Mahabharata has very long elaborations on points of theology, on points of ritual, on points of asceticism and so on. The Ramayana is basically just, here's the story of Ram. There's a little bit at the beginning and the end about Ram being an avatar, being a manifestation of Vishnu in this world. But it kind of doesn't go beyond that. Which is why some scholars have argued that the first and the last book of the Ramayana, which kind of sort of give the sort of the theological context for the story that is told in the middle chapters, in the middle books, this are kind of late traditions. Some of the most prominent Ramayana scholars today have actually argued that no, these are integral to the text. If you cut these chapters off, you don't have a Ramayana. It's kind of the stories that are told, particularly the last book, that are kind of told in the Ramayana, kind of reach their culmination in the final book, and you cut that one off and there is no ending to the text, and so it doesn't work. But anyway, that's kind of a debate that's sort of ongoing. But the Ramayana is sort of less didactic in that, and sort of doesn't place itself so clearly sort of in relation to these. But the Mahabharata very consciously does that, and in doing that is saying we're a more important text. And this is something that we will see other texts that we'll talk about later also do, such as the Puranas, which are the ancient tales that are told in the Chandogya. So you have the histories and the ancient tales. That's the translation of the word Purana, which are also narrative texts that are sort of in some ways similar to the Mahabharata in sort of their style, but are kind of a separate category. So we'll talk about those later. But they also claim to be the fifth of the Vedas. And therefore of a more sort of a not just an equal status, but a more elevated status than the Vedic text, in the sense that they're more accessible and easier to read and so on than the Vedic text. So you see, if you look at the Mahabharata, you have sort of, it sees itself as part of the all the other texts we've so far talked about, and yet there's also an internal critique of all those texts. And so it's very typical of all these Hindu texts is that they're not just kind of saying, oh, here, we're just saying the same thing that's been said before, but it's we're saying the same thing that has been said before, and we're also going to critique what has been said before, because that has to be understood in the proper light. And so it's kind of giving authority to the other texts, but yet also sort of reinterpreting the other texts in the light of other ideas. And so dharma is subtle. It cannot be sort of codified into text. Brahman of the Upanishads is actually a person, is a personal god, is Vishnu, who's at the origin, who's from whom the world comes, by whom the world is maintained, into whom the world dissolves, and who sort of descends into this world as an avatar, as a descent, in order to uphold dharma, and yet kind of has very sort of complicates our understanding of dharma in doing that as well. Yeah. Does that make sense? The Mahabharata is a really, it's a great story. If you've never read it or never seen it, I do recommend it. It's a fantastic sort of, a very sort of complex narrative. There's a lot of retellings of it and sort of abbreviations of it. And pretty much anyone you pick up, they're kind of worth reading just for the story alone. It's kind of, you know, all these characters as you read through the Mahabharata, they're real characters. You know, they all have their own personalities, and they really come out sort of very sort of, they become very vivid in your imagination, as you know who these characters are, and kind of all of them are commenting on what it is to be a Kshatriya, what it is to follow Kshatriya dharma, and in doing that, all kind of conflict with each other in some ways, and kind of leave you to decide, okay, what is it that we should follow. So if you haven't read it, I recommend it. If you want a sort of a shorter version, Peter Brooks did a movie of it. He did a play and then turned it into a movie, which kind of captures the tension of dharma quite well in it, I think. But anyway, that's kind of that in a nutshell. Any questions or?